Fourth grade, your argument from the late part, part six, five.
Same argument for later, if you can.
Thank you, your honors, counsel. My name is Dennis Kelly, here with my associate Sally Smith today to present this argument from my client, the relator, Mr. William Pryor. This is an original proceeding in the Supreme Court seeking a writ of habeas corpus. It arises out of a contempt hearing in the 308th District Court out of Harris County, Texas, the Honorable Bob Robertson presiding. My client, Mr. Pryor, had a divorce pending in the 308th District Court that was subject to signing of the final decree on April the 17th, 1990. A motion for a new trial was filed on April the 18th, a day after the order, the decree was signed. Mr. Pryor was ordered to execute certain written documents. He did not do so. On the 15th of June, 1990, there was several motions heard by Judge Robertson. One was our motion to dismiss the motion for contempt, which was also pending that day, the motion for a new trial, and the motion for contempt. After the motion for new trial was overruled and signed, then we proceeded on with the motion for contempt. Mr. Pryor was found in contempt and put into the Harris County Jail. We applied for a writ for a motion to leave to file the writ of habeas corpus with the 14th Court of Appeals in Harris County, Texas. That writ was, that leave to file was denied, whereupon we applied to the Supreme Court for an original proceeding for leave to file writ of habeas corpus.
So the status is the divorce decree is final. Is it being appealed?
Yes, sir, it is.
And he still hasn't signed the documents?
No, sir, he has not. And our position is that the order upon which the contempt is based, it is not a final order. Therefore, the contempt order itself is void and unenforceable. I think that there's no question that there are two kinds of orders that are enforceable by contempt. First of all, we have any final order. Courts have historically granted lower courts the ability to enforce their own orders by contempt procedures on any kind of final rulings. Legislatively, the Texas legislature has enacted the Texas Family Code, specifically Section 3.58 and Section 1111. In Mr. Pryor's case, we're dealing with a Title I suit, which 3.58 of the Texas Family Code is applicable. Section 3.58, subsections F, H, and I speak to the fact that on a temporary order, on a Title I suit, that's a husband-wife case, that the trial court retains the power after the appellate process starts to grant temporary orders. Subsection I specifically grants jurisdiction to the district courts to retain jurisdiction to enforce their temporary orders, and that section was just amended two sessions of legislature ago to give us the ability, give the trial courts the ability to maintain that the temporary orders, the enforceability of the temporary orders.
Counsel, why wouldn't the court have power under the Government Code Section 21.001, which points out that a court has the inherent power and duty to enforce all of its orders, and that seems to have been recognized by Justice Greenhill writing for this court in 1979 in Garina, and wherein he points out the power to punish for contempt is an inherent power of the court and an essential element of judicial independence and authority. Why couldn't that section be used?
Strictly, Your Honor, because the order that was used in this case was not the same order that Justice Greenhill was referring to in the Garina case. because that was a final order. In this case, this is not a final order, and it was one that was on appeal.
And why I think, could it still not be used?
I think the differential is succinct. Because it is not a final order, because the trial court has the ability to vacate, modify, correct, or even rescind the judgment, that if there is an appeal and the order is vacated or it is turned over by the trial court or by an appellate court, then what has basically happened is the relator or the defendant in the contempt case would have been incarcerated for an order that later on was proven to be or was overturned.
So you mean to tell me if the trial court says appear for a deposition tomorrow at 2 and you say no, that the trial judge can't enforce that by contempt until after there's been an appeal and the judgment's final?
Not at all, sir. I think that the court has inherent powers under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure to enforce by contempt for failure to discover. Rule 215, entire sequence, it gives the court those abilities to enforce.
But the government code doesn't place any of these limitations on the power to enforce by contempt.
I understand, Your Honor, but the government code, nowhere in the government code in that provision, Your Honor, does it say that there is enforceability by contempt for a non-appeal, an order that is being appealed. That is non-final order.
But it doesn't say that there is not that authority. It simply says that that's part of the inherent power of the court.
Yes, sir. And statutorily, the legislature has given the courts the power to enforce their temporary orders. I do not mean to impugn any court's ability to enforce its own orders, because they have to have that ability. On the other hand, Mr. Pryor is appealing this case, and should the case be overturned, then he would have been put in jail for an act that later on was proven to be a corrected or reformed or vacated judgment.
But
secondly,
isn't that very solid jurisprudence that the trial court can order you to do something, and if you refuse, you could be held in contempt, even if the order never should have been entered?
I think that the methodology of what order is used is at issue here. There's no question that statutorily the court had the authority under temporary orders to enter any order and be enforceable by contempt. The cases that we've cited in our brief of Ex parte Valdez, Ex parte Bible, Ex parte Oliver, all speak to the fact that an appealable, non-final judgment is not subject to incarceration by contempt.
And Valdez cites no authority, and the other two rely on Valdez.
I agree that these are cases of first impression, as I think this is a case of first impression with this court. I don't think this court has written on this issue. I would point out that there are remedies for Judge Robertson and Mrs. Pryor, in that she can seek temporary relief pending appeal. There's nothing to say that she can't do that. There are the 3.70 remedies in the Texas Family Code for enforcement. What's happened here, though, under Valdez, Bible, and the Oliver case, is that while there is an appeal going on under that authority, the court does not have the ability to order Mr. Pryor to order to sign those documents at that time. And I would point out that if the court will look at the 329B of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, wherein it talks about finality of judgments, the finality of the judgment cannot be accomplished until 30 days after the motion for new trial has been overruled by written order or by operational law. Certainly on June the 15th, Judge Robertson still had plenary power to vacate, correct, modify that judgment up through July the 15th. And as an example, when we take the Rule 627 in terms of executions, Mrs. Pryor could not even have approached the clerk of the court to ask for an execution on the property until such days after, until 30 days after Mr. Pryor perfected his appeal. Therefore,
counsel, let me ask
yes,
you
sir.
A question. It's undisputed that from the date the petition is filed, the court has the power to enter temporary orders which may be enforced by contempt. You cited section 3.58 of the Family Code, which is entitled Temporary Orders Before Judgment or During the Pendency of an Appeal. Going to subparagraph H, the orders that we're talking about may be on motion of any party or on the motion of the court itself. Why cannot the court do what it did here under 3.58 subparagraph H?
I think the court in Valdez spoke to that very issue very succinctly, Your Honor. And they said it is not possible for this court to separate that portion of the judgment dealing with relator's use of the Avondale property from the remainder of the trial court's judgment. Such a severance would be necessary if this court is to hold that the order in question was temporary and therefore enforceable by contempt proceedings prior to the time that judgment became final, continuing on, telling the trial court, when entering an order intended to be temporary, pending the final disposition of the case on the merits, should clearly indicate the purpose. And my point here is all we have is a document purported to be final decree of divorce, which is enforced as a temporary order. And I don't think this court or any court can look at that decree and sever out what portion is supposed to be temporary, what portion is supposed to be final. I would also point out to the court that as a point that my position is that the order is interlocutory at best anyway, because it did not dispose of all the parties and all the issues even on April the 17th when the order was signed. I don't think it's a final order even today. I think it's interlocutory in nature.
Well, counsel, since 3.58 says that the court does have the power even during appeal to enter orders on its own motion, and then we go to 3.58 subparagraph I, it says the court retains jurisdiction to enforce orders entered under subsection H unless the appellate court on proper showing supersedes the court's order.
Yes, sir. And I think everyone can understand how a case that is supposed to be appealed, a trial court might want to preserve and protect property, which is the idea of 3.58. Preserving and protecting property, this is a transference of property that is already done vis-a-vis the decree of divorce. Judge Robertson's ruling has nothing to do with preserving and protecting property. That property has already been disposed of one way or the other by the decree. If this had to do with continuing alimony, there would certainly be some temporary order that's entered as an individual judgment pending appeal, but the trial court would have the ability to enforce as a temporary order.
If the judge were afraid that one spouse might, he's divided the property, there's been a decree entered, but he's afraid that before the property can be transferred, one spouse may secrete, hide, give away, or dispose of the property, doesn't the judge have the right to require the transfer of title to the property to protect the property during the appeal?
No question he's got that ability. And several remedies. The decree itself protects and preserves the property. Entering any temporary order enjoining either of the parties of disposing it, appointing a receiver to take over the properties. The receiver is an appealable issue once it's appointed. And our problem is that the methodology used was to use an order that was on appeal as opposed to a temporary order. There's many cases involving temporary orders that are enforced by contempt. If he would have done it that way, we probably wouldn't be here, Your Honor. He chose to do it the same methodology that was used in the Valdez case, the Bible case, and the Oliver case, which have been, it's the same fact situation exactly.
Has the decree been superseded?
the decree has not been superseded, Your Honor. And in that regard, again, I would urge that superseded or not, I don't think it makes any difference in terms of Mrs. Pryor being able to receive the property prior to July the 15th. She could not have even asked for a writ of execution, yet Judge Robertson used his coercive power to put my client in jail for failure to turn the property over. I think those are two positions which cannot be reconciled if this motion for contempt is allowed to stand.
May it please the court, counselor. My name is Bucky Allshouse from Houston. I represent Lily Pryor, the respondent in this matter. The issue appears to be whether the Valdez, Oliver, and Bible case are appropriate authority for the proposition that a trial court cannot enforce its order until it's final. And the question of, to me, is what is meant by what is final, number one, and number two, whether that's appropriate law. In this particular case, the trial court entered a decree of divorce, ordered Mr. Pryor to appear to sign documents the day after the judgment was signed. It is our position that the trial court had the authority to enforce that order, with or without regard to the fact that the case is on appeal or whether there's a motion for a new trial. It is our position that the Valdez, Oliver, and Bible case are not valid authority for the proposition that the court cannot enforce its order. It appears to me that the problem with the reasoning of Mr. Pryor's counsel is the proposition that the trial court's judgment is not valid to start with. It has always been my belief that the trial court judgment is presumed valid if there is evidence to support it. It's my position that if the trial court makes an order, that it should be followed by the parties, and that Mr. Pryor had appropriate remedies and protection by filing a supersedious bond, and or by filing the proper injunctions preventing the sale of property after he transferred the property to Ms. Pryor. I cannot find any distinction in my mind to say that a trial court cannot enforce a final judgment, but it can enforce a temporary order, or it can enforce a direct order of the court. I find no distinction mentioned in the government code or anywhere else that prevents that from happening. So it is our position that the order is a valid final order and it disposes of all the properties, disposes of all the issues before the court, and is as final as far as a final judgment is concerned for appeal purposes. Certainly it is not a final judgment if it is on appeal, but the question is how do you take steps to enforce provisions in a decree of divorce, setting forth specific language requiring someone to appear at a time, place, and time certain, if you have to indicate that it has to be at a date certain after all appellate timetable is resolved and the issue is resolved by a court of appeals, the Supreme Court.
If Mr. Pryor had been ordered to execute documents in a temporary order, he could have appealed that, I assume.
I beg your pardon?
If Mr. Pryor had been ordered to sign documents in a temporary order, he could have appealed that order, I assume.
No, sir. In essence, a temporary order pending a divorce is not appealable except for certain issues with regard to injunctions or receiverships. He could not appeal from a temporary order, as I understand it, pending appeal in the same matter, perhaps if the court appointed a receiver. Now, I don't know if you can say, quote, these temporary orders are in effect. I'm ordering you to sign these documents or sign this deed over.
So when does he get to argue to another court, in an appellate forum, that he didn't have to sign these documents? He shouldn't have been required to.
He would argue that, Judge, in front of the Court of Appeals. The proper remedy, as I would see it, was he would follow the court's order. That judgment is presumed to be valid. He signs the decree. He signs the documents of conveyance. He asks the court for protection by enjoining the opposing party from disposing of those assets. He then files a supersedious bond protecting his interest, and then the Court of Appeals rules. But the property is in the position of where the trial court's judgment says it should be. That prevents any disposition of the property from the other side. That prevents any type of strangulation or a position of one party having the property or power in their hand and not allowing the other party to go forward with the appeal and survive. With regard to the issue of the interlocutory judgment, I think the facts state that in February 21st, 1990, there was a stipulation entered into open court on the record regarding the severance of the cause of action by intervener Mr. Pavlis, which was agreed to by all counsel, including the counsel for Mr. Pryor. Subsequent to that time, a order was signed by all the attorneys and was filed with the court on March 22, 1990, before the decree was signed. It is true that the order did not get signed until after the decree of divorce was signed on April 27, 1990. I believe, number one, that to be a ministerial act on the part of the court. Number two, I don't think it makes any difference to this proceeding anyways, because there was no appeal from that proceeding, and since it became final, the other judgment became final also. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Any questions?
Briefly, Your Honors, even in a criminal case where a defendant is found guilty of some criminal act, that defendant has the right to stay out of jail on a personal recognizance bond, on a cash bond or surety bond. The presumption of putting somebody in jail until there is some appeal is legion with this state. And this is a very, very serious process by which Judge Robertson is trying to enforce his orders that we're saying is on appeal. And giving...
Why couldn't you have done what opposing counsel said? Signed the documents, requested that Mrs. Pryor be ordered not to transfer the property, supersede the judgment, file a list of pendants, and appeal.
We, as a practical matter, Your Honor, there is no money to post any supersedious bond. Mrs. Pryor is free to, and has, in fact, done her executions on the property, and she can take whatever remedy she wants to under 627, which is execution. But to have my client voluntarily sign over the very property that he is appealing to the 14th Court of Appeals that was an improper characterization and disposition of those properties, he doesn't feel that that is a proper remedy. And if Judge Robertson intended for some methodology to redress or to remedy a temporary situation while this was on appeal, the statutes clearly state what the remedy is, and that is a temporary order pending appeal where the court has the jurisdiction to enforce its temporary orders.
Will the River Oaks Country Club allow a woman to hold a membership?
Yes, sir. I think so. We've talked. I think Mr. Allshouse and I have talked. I don't think that's an issue. And certainly, the decree itself acts as a muniment of title. It transfers the property. It transfers the River Oaks Country Club membership. It transfers the division orders. Having Mr. Proby put in jail for his refusal not to sign some documents that don't transfer the property anyway, I don't think is intended. Nevertheless, as a temporary order, if Judge Robertson thought that that was an appropriate remedy, then certainly he's got the power to do that. Unfortunately, I think he chose the wrong remedy of trying to enforce a decree of divorce that wasn't final, which is contrary to at least our existing case law in Harris County at this time.
A judge would not order the transfer of title to property as a temporary order, would he? Because he has not yet made a division of the property.
Well, if he's made a division of the property vis-a-vis the decree, that is the final transfer of the property, and then temporarily he can do whatever he wants to in terms of injunctions, injunctive relief, appointing a receiver, or enjoining the parties who have the property themselves from doing anything with it until further order of the court.
Could your client not simply have just signed the documents and then filed a Liz Pendens? That would have protected any interest or that your client had in the real property.
Your Honor, I don't know how a Liz Pendens affects the River Oaks Country Club membership, and I really don't know how a Liz Pendens affects the division orders in different states. And basically, our position is that the Judge Robertson did not have the power at the time that he did it to enforce his order. This is a very serious question that all the members of the bar are looking at, and it'll have repercussions to everybody in the state of Texas, and we need to have some definition on it. If there's no more questions, I appreciate the honor of being before you.
Are there any questions? Thank you. I conclude the argument.